Tuesday's primary election brought few, if any, surprises from the top of the ticket to the most local state legislative races. And we will discuss those races as well as other political matters on this week's Eastern Standard. We have gathered a group of reporters around our table for a reporters roundtable, and we're going to encourage you to participate in the conversation with your questions, your comments, your observations about this week's election and the entire presidential election process this year, as well as other matters that are on your mind. We encourage you to participate by sending an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. You can send a tweet at WEKUEST, post on the WEKU Facebook page or website as well. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR on 88.9 WEKU. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen, and on this Thursday morning during our live broadcast, we're just 2 days past the 2016 Kentucky primary election, and we decided there would be no other and more appropriate topic to pursue on this week's program than the election. So we've gathered around our table a group of reporters who have been no strangers to the WEKU microphones, but today everybody is here face-to-face, so we're actually having a roundtable discussion around our table, and we're going to ask for their reactions to Tuesday's elections. Any surprises on their minds? Any projections for how things are going to move forward during this very important election year? And we're going to ask for your input. Our program is an interactive program. We invite listeners to participate by email, by Twitter, by Facebook, by the website, or by telephone. And we will go ahead and give you all of that contact information right now so you can offer any questions you may have for the reporters who are here, as well as any comments or personal stories. First of all, the email address, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. The Twitter address, at WEKUEST. The Facebook account, just look up WEKU on Facebook or go to the website, weku.fm. And that phone number, 800-621-8890. With us in the studio today are Ryland Barton, Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief. Ryland, thank you for joining us once again.
Hey, John.
With us also is Ronnie Ellis, Capital Bureau correspondent for CNHI News, also the Richmond Register. Ronnie, a regular visitor to the studios. Thank you, Ronnie, for being with us.
It's always a pleasure.
And Adam Beam has been on with us before. This is my first opportunity to meet Adam in person. Thanks for making the trip down from Frankfort today. Adam is a Kentucky State House correspondent for the Associated Press, and our listeners are frequently reading your work in, I'm sure, the Richmond Register, other papers, and constantly getting reports that you are providing. Thank you, Adam.
Well, I'm sure they read Ronnie before they read me.
I'm
glad to be here.
Among this panel are some of the folks who are really right at the core of what's going on, especially in Frankfort, and we're glad to have you guys here this morning. But let's start off, actually, with a report by another reporter, one of our intrepid reporters who seems to be everywhere during most of the major stories. That's WEKU's Stu Johnson. And on Tuesday, primary election day, Stu filed this story, and I thought it'd be a good scene setter to kind of get things going on this sunny day after the rainy days we've had. Stu starts with rainy and cool conditions greeting many Kentucky voters as they cast their ballots on Tuesday in Lexington. Stu Johnson caught up with a few just outside their voting locations.
In South Lexington, Claire Hundley said it's important to make her voice heard, and yet she labeled this primary a scary election.
None of the candidates we're voting for right now is liked by people. Nobody seems to trust any of the candidates, and yet that's what we're faced with.
Debbie Morris, a native of Germany, and her husband Gary cast their ballots. Gary said voter participation in Germany seems higher with more political parties. A few miles away at the Garden Springs Elementary voting location, Tony Wilson said voting is a value he and his family hold high in their home.
For me, it's been difficult in making a decision because it's a pivotal time for our country.
whether you're Republican or Democrat.
Downtown, Stephanie Quinn is from Chicago but has lived in Lexington for 10 years. She believes the visits by Hillary and Bill Clinton and Bernie Sanders demonstrates Kentucky is an influential state this primary. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
One of the questions raised by Stu Johnson's story would be the issue of voter turnout. And why don't we start there? I wonder if our panel of journalists, Ryland Barton, Ronnie Ellis, Adam Beam, anyone has heard anything in terms of the final numbers on voter turnout. Secretary of State Allison Lundergan Grimes was projecting the possibility of 20% turnout. Was that too high?
No, it looks like she was dead on. It was about, I think, right under 21% turnout statewide. I think the turnout, you know, varied by different counties depending on where you were, but it was right at 20%. However, you know, I think that's a combination of both the Democratic and the Republican primaries. I think the Democratic primary had a little bit higher turnout than the Republican simply because they didn't have a presidential race on the ballot. And, you know, in presidential election years, the presidential primary, that's a really big turnout driver for these races, and the Republicans suffered for that.
Was there still some confusion among some voters? I know in some counties especially, there was an effort being made to encourage Republican voters to come on out, that there will be something on the ballot despite the fact that there had been a caucus.
I'm sure there was. I did not find any voters, Republican voters, who knew that. All the voters that I spoke to, I visited three precincts in the first congressional district, and they were all very well aware that they had no presidential primary, and they knew what they were voting for. But I'm sure that happened somewhere.
That was my experience as well, that the voters I spoke to the Republican voters were quite cognizant of what was going on. On the other hand, our reporter up in Ashland reported that one of the papers we own is in Ashland, and she reported that precinct workers thought it was affecting Republican turnout up there. That tends to be a Democratic area, but it may have up there.
I heard the same thing, that there was in some of the voting locations I went to, that it was affecting Republican turnout. I mean, I guess in this case, Republicans aren't facing off against Democrats, so it's just a smaller pool that Republicans are voting within. I think you could certainly see that within the Senate race. A whole lot fewer people ended up voting for Rand Paul, say, because, you know, probably fewer people, Republicans, were going out to the vote than, say, people who are voting for Jim Gray. Just on a kind of cursory looking over the voter turnout, you could see a lot more Democrats.
So from that point of view, it will not be possible to do a little projection into November and take a look at the number of people who cast votes for Rand Paul versus the number of people who cast votes for Jim Gray.
Yeah, it wouldn't really be fair in a couple ways. I mean, one, again, because Republicans didn't have presidential candidates at the top of the ballot, but also because in that race especially, Rand Paul was running against kind of two nominal candidates who hadn't campaigned very visibly at all.
Well, there's another piece of that equation that makes such projections a little bit dicey. Increasingly, Kentucky has a large, significant block of voters who are registered Democrats but vote Republican. I mean, they are Republican in their voting patterns. And so that skews the numbers from a primary as well.
Let's talk about the issue of the closed primary. I know I've personally run into people who were very, very upset that they either were unable to vote on Tuesday or that they wanted to change their registration and they wanted to vote Democratic. Someone told me they were an independent, and they went to the county clerk's office to change their registration to become a Democrat, I think 30 days before the election or so, and they were very, very wrong in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been kind of a hot-button political issue. You know, I'm from South Carolina originally. South Carolina has open primaries. Anybody can vote. And, of course, the big debate down there is, oh, we have these people crossing over, voting in our primaries, picking our candidates. And there's been a big effort down there to close the primaries, but it's never happened. And just likewise, there seems to be some efforts up here to open up the primaries. Secretary of State Allison Lundgren Grimes, you know, Kentucky's chief election official, made some comments to that effect when she was giving her turnout projections. She said that she felt like it was time to open up the primaries. I don't see it happening anytime soon. Like I said, it's a very political issue, and especially with the way that the chambers are divided now, I can't see them coming to an agreement on that.
Well, and a lot of party officials in either party will tell you, you know, a primary is not technically an election, it's a selection. We're selecting our nominee, And why should, if I'm a Republican, should I allow someone who considers him or herself not a Republican to be a part of that process, or a Democrat, but crossing over? And in some cases, in some states where they do have open primaries, members of the other party cross over to sabotage and hurt the stronger candidate that they'd rather not face. You know, I've been a registered independent for, I don't know, for most of my voting career. And I just, you know, I can change at any time I want. Now, you do have to do it by December 31st, preceding a primary. But I just never have seen the purpose of letting non-Democrats or non-Republicans choose their nominee.
Normally, in most elections, there's publicity about, here's the number to call if you notice any discrepancies at polling places. And I'm sure that information was out there before this election. I guess it's the Secretary of State's office one would call if there are issues. Are we hearing any reports of any discrepancies, any issues, any complaints about how things were operated on Tuesday?
I don't think that there's anything major. I mean, you report to the Attorney General's office, or there's a hotline for that on election day. And over the course of the day, they send out emails, and I think I can't remember how many complaints there were, but it's everything from electioneering, people, campaigning on behalf of candidates within 100 feet of the polls. There were some issues of vote buying, I think. I can't remember what county.
A rich tradition in Kentucky politics.
In Eastern Kentucky especially.
Yes.
It appears that all of these were minor, and I don't think that there's been any talk of a re-canvass or a recount, which ultimately the candidate who wanted to do that would have to pay for.
I believe the Senator Sanders campaign could have asked for a re-canvass in their race. I think it was close enough, but I don't see the point in him doing that, because they were so close. It was effectively a tie. I mean, I know that Secretary Clinton is a couple of thousand or so votes ahead, but they're so close, they're going to split all the delegates mainly, so I don't see a point.
It kind of comes down to Kentucky being, this primary wasn't ever really about the delegates. We've got, it was anywhere estimated between 55 to 61 delegates. I think AP is saying 55 delegates.
It's 55, what they call pledged, that are determined by the election, and then there are five superdelegates, or a total of 60.
But anyway, it all just kind of comes down to momentum going forward into the really big primaries of California and New Jersey, which I think are on June 7th. And so Kentucky's delegates weren't, really that big in that pool. But momentum going forward, Hillary Clinton was really trying to break up some of Bernie Sanders' momentum, who had been, he had won, I think, 7 of the previous 12 primaries. In this, she gets the check in the win column. She won Kentucky by 2,000 votes, but in the end, they just kind of split the delegates right down the middle.
We have a group of reporters gathered around our table for this week's Eastern Standard. Ryland Barton is Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief. Adam Beam is Kentucky State House Correspondent for the Associated Press. Ronnie Ellis, Capital Bureau Correspondent for CNHI News. And we are interested in hearing from you. What was your experience on Tuesday when you went to vote? Did you choose to vote? Did you abstain from voting, either because you are an independent or because nothing really appealed to you? What about Republican voters, because there was no primary on the ballot for you this year? How did that affect your voting on Tuesday? 800-621-8890. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST, or post on the Facebook page or the WEKU website. That phone number once again, 800-621-8890. Email wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, a Reporters Roundtable, our program this week. We have with us Ryland Barton, Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief, Adam Beam, Kentucky State House Correspondent for the Associated Press, Ronnie Ellis, Capital Bureau Correspondent for CNHI News. And we're beginning our conversation talking about the Tuesday primary election. We're interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories, your reflections on the process. and maybe Kentucky's role in the primary and the presidential nomination process this year. 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Post on Facebook or on the website or send a tweet at WEKUEST. And let me just toss this out to our reporters around the table this morning. Has Kentucky's status changed? I know the Republicans chose to hold a caucus in March in order to accommodate the dual candidacies of Senator Rand Paul, who was at the time running for president of the United States while continuing to run for re-election to his Senate seat. That brought the Republican process a little farther up on the calendar into March so that it did not end up with a May primary, which is relatively late in the game, although apparently Kentucky was in play as far as Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton was concerned. They actually came to Kentucky and have made some visits to the state. Has our status risen as a result of what's been going on this year, Adam Beam?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the Republicans had hoped that by having an earlier date on the calendar for a caucus, that that would attract more candidate visits, more media attention. I think that did not happen by and large. We had I think two candidates visit. I think Donald Trump visited once, and I believe was it Rubio?
It was Ben Carson.
Yeah, not even Rubio. Ben Carson. Okay, so just two candidates came in the week before, and there wasn't that much attention, I think, on Kentucky as they had hoped. But meanwhile, the Democrats had their primary, and Clinton and Sanders were everywhere. I mean, they were everywhere, all over the place, popping up, surprising. I mean, Senator Sanders showed up in Frankfort by surprise on Saturday. So I don't think it really changed much of anything. It'll be interesting to see going forward if Republicans want to keep this caucus in 4 more years. Maybe it'll have an impact then as far as attention to Kentucky goes.
Well, but conversely, whoever is the Democratic nominee, even if it's Clinton, I doubt we see much of them in the fall. I don't think Kentucky's influence has greatly changed because we have we had a caucus this year, more or less for the benefit initially of Rand Paul, who had previously been called the most interesting man in politics by Time magazine. He is someone that the national media have followed since he got to Washington. We have the majority leader of the U.S. Senate from Kentucky, and we've got this gubernatorial feud between the most recent governor and the current governor. I think we'll get lots of attention. I just don't think our influence has grown very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, sure, Republicans did get a little bit more press. They did get Donald Trump, and, that was a big rally that did get quite a bit of press, at least that one did, and Ben Carson had some a little bit of press. But if they hadn't switched to the primary, or if they hadn't switched to the caucus, they would have been on this primary this previous Tuesday, and heck, the nominating process was done by then. Democrats, though, interestingly enough, being such a late in the game primary, did have all the press, did get a lot of attention, even for such a kind of relatively small number of delegates. Yeah, I think we'll just kind of see going forward whether or not Republicans think that little bit of press that they got from moving it forward, even in that caucus, was really in kind of the most contentious time during the primary race. I mean, at that point, it was Rubio, Cruz, and Trump really duking it out at the top there, or at least in the press, they were duking it out at the top.
And, both the parties here in Kentucky like to talk about timing issues diminishing our influence. It's not really timing. It's the fact that we have so few electoral votes relative to the rest of some of the larger states. And number two, because we are a reliable red state in the fall. It's no different than small, reliably blue states in the fall. The candidates don't go and campaign in those states where they don't either worry about their own prospects or think they have a chance to win.
So are we going to see any increased attention during the general election campaign? 2012 that was the first presidential election that I spent my time completely in Kentucky, and no one came.
I doubt it. The Clintons have a relationship with Kentucky going back to the late 70s, and of course they are close to the Lundergan family and Allison Lundergan Grimes. They'll probably come into Louisville for a fundraiser. But I don't see them campaigning here because if Hillary Clinton gets beat in Pike County, where in 2008 she got 90% of the vote, and I don't think she expects to beat Donald Trump in the fall.
In Kentucky.
In Kentucky, right. I'm sorry.
800-621-8890. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We invite listeners to be part of our conversation. It's a reporters' roundtable. We have Adam Beam, Ronnie Ellis, and Ryland Barton around the table, and you are welcome to be part of the conversation at 800-621-8890 or send an email, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Are you burned out on politics? How are you feeling about the rest of this year that we're going to endure? And the inundation of advertising and the campaigning that is going to be geared to most of the rest of the country, and then Kentucky likely to be ignored to a great extent by the candidates. Do we think that Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump will make an effort to come to Kentucky?
I've given up trying to predict what Donald Trump's going to do. I mean, he runs a very unconventional campaign, so who knows? Maybe he'll come and have a bunch of rallies here. But typically, going back and looking at elections past, states like Kentucky have not been in play because it's been a given who's going to win. So I don't see them coming to make an effort here.
And when Kentucky is in play, whether it's primary or general election season, it's when it's too close to call and they're scrambling for every last delegate. Now, if we end up in a situation like that, perhaps. Traditionally, however, in recent election cycles, I don't think a lot of people realize it, but the Democrats start out with a reliable base of about 240 electoral votes. So that's why we see these campaigns fought in 7 or 8, 10 states. Now, if it gets down to the point where it's too close to call, yeah, they'll be in Kentucky looking for every last delegate they can electoral vote they can find.
Let's go to the phone, and you mentioned Pike County, Ronnie. Let's talk to David from Pike County, who is on the line. Thank you, David, for calling. You are on the air. Let's see. Let's punch that button another time. We're good? We're good, David? Go ahead. Give it a go. Are you there? Hello, David.
This is Paul.
Paul, I'm sorry, Paul. Somehow we've got your name confused. But, Paul, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, yes. I'm 68 years old, and I guess I've voted for 50 years, and I've always felt like I had to vote most likely the worst of two evils or something like that. And this is the first year that I really feel that both parties are wanting change and to stop the status quo. And I think that a lot of the politicians, old politicians, and the media have not really realized that these changes are coming, whether they embrace them or not. So that's just my comment.
So when you say the parties are wanting change, you're talking about the voters, the members of
yes,
the party.
Yes, the members, right. You know, I think the RNC and the DNC have more or less put on a show pretending that we have a voice in the past, and now they're starting to realize that we do have a voice and we want something done.
So to our media panel around the table here, is this the core of the support for Donald Trump and the relatively strong movement for Bernie Sanders, the discontent with the parties as we've known them?
Well, I think Paul's right. I think that's exactly what's going on. And I do think that's why Trump has been successful and to some degree Bernie Sanders, even though they seem to be so far apart. I don't know that the DNC or the RNC knows how to deal with it. But yes, I think it's out there, and I think we see it expressed in voters' behavior at the polls.
Yeah, and there's an interesting theory out there that, you know, so the people that vote for Bernie Sanders are going to go vote for Trump. And, you know, on the face of that, that looks completely ridiculous because their policy positions are completely opposite of each other. But yet, you know, if you're a voter who doesn't really, your policy positions are not your number one priority. Your number one priority is, you know, revolution, or I mean, that's too strong of a word, but, you know, change, getting people in there who have completely different ideas and, you know, completely, you know, buck the status quo. then, you know, maybe a lot of Sanders voters could cross over to vote for Trump. Who knows?
Well, I think in Kentucky they definitely will, and I think it's more than just the revolutionary thing. I think it's coal. Again, Sanders won every coal-producing county in the state. You can make the argument that Henderson County didn't count or should have counted. She won that. They're not actively mining coal, but they have in the past and still have reserves in the ground. But I think those are Democrats who are going to vote for Trump in the fall. And I don't know what the number is, but I think they're concentrated in eastern Kentucky, and I think it makes it virtually impossible for her to win in the fall.
I think one of the biggest examples of this change is that, you know, Hillary Clinton had endorsements from, you know, all the kind of top state Democratic leaders. She had done very well here in the past in the primary in 2008. And so even though we didn't have any public polling here for this presidential primary election, it seemed, in Kentucky, Hillary was kind of, you know, it seemed like all logic would point to her doing well in the state, and yet she just eked out, you know, with a 2,000 vote, less than 2,000 vote lead over Sanders.
Paul, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Phone lines open, 800-621-8890. Send us an email to WEKUEasternStandard@gmail.com. A tweet can be sent at WEKUEST, and you can certainly post on the website or the Facebook page, especially after the live broadcast, the show repeating on Sunday evening. If you'd like to carry on the conversation, the website and the Facebook page are a great place to do that. Before I go back to our listener comments or questions, to our reporters, Ronnie Ellis, Adam Beam, and Rylan Barton, were there any surprises Tuesday night when you finished filing your stories at 3:30 in the morning or whatever it was? Was there anything that left you going, I didn't expect that?
I really don't think so. Not certainly in the bigger races. I don't think anybody was surprised at Senator Sanders and his strength here. I think all the and the, for the federal races, everybody who was supposed to win won. All the incumbents won. Jamie Comer in the first district, who had a decided fundraising advantage and name ID advantage, won. I think there were some two incumbents lost. Tom Reiner, a longtime Democrat from Louisville, and Ron Krim, a longtime Republican, both from Louisville. Both of them lost, although, you know, looking at the candidates they were running against in their districts, it wasn't, you know, it was shocking, but it was still, anytime an incumbent loses, you need to take notice.
And both lost big, too.
Right, and Ronnie and I were talking a little bit before the show about Speaker Stumbo and his district. For a while there, early on in the night, it looked like Speaker Stumbo was going to have a race on his hands until he pulled away. And that was somewhat surprising, although he did end up winning by a comfortable margin, Ronnie. I don't think it was as comfortable as he had expected.
No, it's not what you would expect Greg Stumbo to do in Floyd County over the years, but he still won easily.
Does he have a strong Republican challenger?
Well, you know, Republicans are an endangered species historically in Floyd County, but he does have a Republican challenger. I know, and I'm trying to remember which cycle it was, probably 2 cycles ago, 4 years ago, someone that I was doing a story on in Floyd County pointed to that race where he beat the Republican quite handily, and the fellow pointed out that perhaps he had problems for a Republican to get that many votes in Floyd County. But I doubt Greg Stumbo's in any serious trouble now.
All right, let's go back to the telephone and talk to Carter from Knott County, see if I can get the names correct this time. Carter, you are on the air. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. You got it right on the nail there. That's my name.
Great. Thanks for calling.
I have one comment there, I guess. You know, that's sad to say, you know, but I guess this country, we'll just have to, you know, make the best with what we got to work with, you know. But my question is it's about that super delegate deal there. I haven't ever had anyone explain that to me exactly how that deal works there. You know, some says that them super delegates overrides all the rest of them, and, you know, I don't know how that process works, you know.
Super delegates are basically uncommitted delegates. They are delegates for the party who are not they can decide who they vote for. And typically in the Democratic Party, they're more prominent than in the Republicans. The Republicans have their version of superdelegates, but mostly we're talking about the Democratic Party for superdelegates. These are the party, state party chairperson. In this case, it's Sandy Overly. You've got the national committee man and the national committee woman for the Democratic National Committee. John Yarmuth, congressman, is a superdelegate. And the thinking behind that was that these are party leaders who, in the midst of, some type of contentious convention, could come together and offer guidance to the delegates at large in their state over who they should vote
guidance
for.
With quote marks around it,
I
think.
Yeah, guidance. yeah, exactly.
Like to put us back on course while the party mainstream?
That's right. The thinking is party leaders deserve, I guess, some more latitude to be able to choose who they want.
On the Democratic side, they are an outgrowth or the product of a series of electoral losses that the Democrats went through in the 70s and 80s. And the party elders, the party wise men and women, were being locked out of the process. They are not a majority. They're not anywhere close to a majority. They do, in fact, in most instances, follow the vote patterns in their state, but they don't have to. And the other function, it was to keep some of the party old hands involved in the selection process, so they theoretically got a stronger candidate for the fall. The other piece of it is that if the nominee is elected, these are the people that he or she will need in order to enact their agenda, and therefore you want those folks on board and involved in the process.
I think that you make a good point, Ronnie, in that they're superdelegates. They get to choose who they want, but they also have to answer to the public for who they choose. And in 2008, I think is a good example of that. Most of the superdelegates were aligned with Secretary Clinton early on, and then as President Obama gained momentum, you saw them gradually switch over because they didn't want to be on the wrong side.
And the whole philosophy behind it being kind of trying to make sure that the party elects a candidate that, nominates a candidate that they find is to be electable, which can turn out to be a pretty controversial decision when you're in a primary like we are now, where it's like, what makes you say that this person is electable over this other person?
Does that help, Carter?
I was kind of misinformed there, understanding I had was kind of like the Electoral College, even if the popular vote, they won by the popular vote, but yet the Electoral College vote overrides the popular vote, stuff.
Well, for instance, in Kentucky, there are 55 delegates who, at least on the first ballot, must vote according to the vote back in Kentucky. There are only five superdelegates. Now, even what was called the pledge delegate that follows the vote pattern of the people, they're bound only on the first ballot. After that, if there's not a nominee on the first ballot, anybody can vote for anyone they wish.
All right, Carter, thank you so much. Very, very important question. Thank you for bringing that up.
Appreciate you.
Oh, thanks for being part of the show. 800-621-8890 is our number. You can email us, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. It's a reporter's roundtable. We have with us Ronnie Ellis, Rylan Barton, and Adam Beam. Reporters covering the Kentucky State House, keeping their eye on politics and talking about this past week's primary election in Kentucky. We may wander off into some other stories in the next few minutes, but you're certainly welcome to come back with some more questions, comments, personal stories about the election at 800-621-8890, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU station's Reporters Roundtable, and we are focusing primarily on the primary election of this week. 800-621-8890, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Our guests around the table are Adam Beam of the Associated Press, Rylan Barton of Kentucky Public Radio, and Ronnie Ellis of CNHI Newspapers, including the Richmond Register. An emailed question that came in from Amy. Amy says, I learned that Bourbon County was in school on Election Day. Isn't that illegal or go against teachers' rights? So normally, don't schools cancel or aren't they closed on Election Day?
They are normally. I think the reason in this case was I think the legislature made a special provision for snow days this year and allowed them, in some cases, to be open. I don't think the actual building where there was an election maybe could be open, but I think they made a special provision in the budget this year.
It might have been, I mean, I'm getting dangerous here because I'm talking without notes in front of me, but I think it was like if the school wasn't used as a precinct, right? I mean, there's no reason to close it.
So the reason for closing the schools is because so many of the schools are used as election locations, as precincts, as polling places.
I think that's one of the big reasons they do it, but also I think, you know, giving teachers and other people a chance to go out to the polls to vote.
But there's still provisions that you have to give people a certain number of hours off to go vote on voting day as well.
For state workers there are. I don't know how that works for school districts, but I'm sure.
Let's go back to the phone and talk to Charles from Lexington. And Charles, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering if any of the reporters had any inside information on what happened in Jefferson County, why their reports were so late in getting in, you know, finally closing them out, because they reported after Western Kentucky for their final hit, and that's what put Hillary over the top. And I'm just wondering if there's any scuttlebutt around about what happened in Jefferson County.
I am not aware of any scuttlebutt as far as any kind of shenanigans.
That's the word I used in my earlier idea. That's right.
Especially regarding those two precincts, because if I recall correctly, and maybe Adam or Rylan will correct me, but if I recall correctly, when Secretary Grimes went on CNN and said there were only two left with an insufficient number of Democratic votes to change the outcome, she said they were in the eastern corridor of Jefferson County, which is the more affluent end of Jefferson County, also the more Republican end of Jefferson County. I do, in fact, think that Ms. Clinton won the race in Jefferson County in the West End. I haven't been able to look at the numbers to determine, but she gave special focus and emphasis on the African-American community in the West End of Louisville. And on Sunday before the election, visited two churches over there, had the backing of some influential ministers. And I know
John Yarmouth took her around, I heard.
Yarmouth did, and there's a fellow over in the West End, a wonderfully colorful fellow named Clarence Yancey, who's been a political activist over there for forever, Democrat. He was involved in getting her out in that community as well. So I suspect in a 1,900 vote margin, they provided the difference, but I am unaware of any rumors of shenanigans.
And this is just speculation on my part, but I mean, Jefferson County is the largest county in the state. I mean, how many precincts do they have? Hundreds, maybe?
Hundreds, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these western Kentucky counties are very small. A lot of their precincts are very small. They don't have many votes to count. So it could have just been, it just took them that long to count the votes. That could be a possibility.
Okay. Right. I don't think there'll be many Bernie supporters voting for Trump, I promise. Okay. But, you know, Trump's going to win Kentucky anyway. So I'll sign off. You'll vote enough.
The reason I think some of those people are going to vote for Trump is I think they are Trump supporters to begin with. And they did not have the option of voting for Trump as registered Democrats.
Okay.
And after Hillary's comments in Ohio, which I think she's justifiable in saying they were taken out of context, but they were still terrible comments to make before going into West Virginia and Kentucky in an election about putting minors out of business. People wanted to register their displeasure with Clinton, and I think those are the people I'm talking about.
All right.
Yeah, okay.
All right,
Charles. Thank you for your time.
Hey, thanks for your call, Charles. Let's jump on over and talk to Rebecca, who is also in Lexington this morning. Rebecca, you are on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm from Lexington and registered Democrat, and I just wanted to say that I did feel the burn. I agonized over the decision between Hillary and Bernie in the booth, and I finally went with Bernie just because I wanted to. And so I overwhelmed strategy, I guess, is the best way to put it. And the question I have is, I've been listening to a lot of the history of the superdelegates and the way our political system or electoral system works now is due to the 1968 anti-war movement and the convention in Chicago and all the calamity that emerged from that time period. And I think it would be good history for the commentators to go over so that people understand that much of what we take as given, such as Iowa and Vermont having this lock on being first, only dates to like the early 70s. It doesn't go back to the beginning of time. And so if they would comment on that, I'd like to hear it. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Rebecca. And there are only a couple of us around the table who were around for the 1968 convention and remember what occurred during that summer for the Democrats in Chicago.
Take it away, Ronnie.
Yeah, I thought that one was probably coming to me. I remember the 68 convention. I remember watching it. I think we're in a much different atmosphere and world, although Senator Dianne Feinstein, I think, was the one who this week said to supporters of Sanders, we don't need another 1968 convention. You had a situation there where you had a couple of idealistic movements within the Democratic nomination process with Bobby Kennedy. But Bobby Kennedy was assassinated before the convention, and Eugene McCarthy. And Hubert Humphrey was the establishment candidate, the vice president to Lyndon Johnson. And, of course, the Vietnam War was at its most unpopular and was the issue of the day. And you had a very authoritarian mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, the elder. And you had the yippies and the hippies descend upon Chicago and protest. And there were pitched battles between police. There were people hospitalized. I just can't envision anything like that this time. But I do think that the Democrats have a chore before them of uniting the party. You know, what the Democrats and the Clinton folks are hoping to compare to is not 1968, but 2008, when she was in the exact position that Bernie Sanders is in this time. And she fought to the very end, to the last ballot was counted. But then, after having her name put into nomination on the first ballot, she walked onto the convention floor and made a motion to nominate Obama by acclamation. That's what they're hoping Sanders' forces will do. But maybe we should ask Rebecca. My sense is we're not there yet. We might be by convention time, but we're certainly not yet.
All right. Let's actually, in the final 10 minutes of our show or so, turn to some other issues. And we talk about the primary election, or at least going forward to the general election this year. I understand that the Kentucky General Assembly is there's a lot of uncertainty about the future of the Kentucky House of Representatives that has been traditionally, for at least a number of years, a Democratic body. It's still holding on right now by, I guess, a hair or a thread. And there's concern among Democrats that they're going to lose control of the House?
That's right. I think while nationally the presidential race is going to get all the attention, in Kentucky the most fascinating races, in my opinion, are going to be for these 100 state House districts. Kentucky right now is the last legislative chamber in the South, still controlled by Democrats. You know, historically, Democrats controlled every chamber in the South. And, you know, they have a very slim majority now. It's 53 Democrats to 47 Republicans. And the narrative for years has been Republicans are gaining momentum, they're gaining influence, and they're going to take control. But, you know, that they just haven't been able to do it. They were supposed to do it in 2014. They were not able to pick up any seats. I think Republicans didn't do as good a job that year in recruiting candidates, enough candidates, quality candidates, to challenge some incumbents. Many of the Democratic incumbents in 2014 did not face opposition. That's not the case this year. This year, I think it's nearly every seat is contested, or I think there's probably a handful that are not. I think Ryland, you said about 91 of the 100 are contested. And so Tuesday was the dress rehearsal for all this, because we had to find out who is going to be against who. And, for example, some of the more interesting results, and in Louisville, you had Representative Denver Butler, who was a longtime Democrat, comes from a big Democratic family, and he switched parties, and now he's a Republican. And so now you've got Mackenzie Cantrell, who is a lawyer, a minimum wage attorney, is going to be running against him as a Democrat in a very Democratic district. Can she win and pick up a seat for the Democrats there? And in Rowan County, you have Rocky Adkins, the House Majority Floor Leader. And, of course, Rowan County is the famous, you know, scene of Kim Davis and all that went on in 2015 last year. And a pastor ran for that seat to get the Republican nomination. He lost. Wendy Fletcher won. Republicans are very excited about her. They think she has a real good chance of putting some pressure on a very powerful, entrenched Democrat. I think Eastern Kentucky is going to be fascinating to look at because they've been voting Republican in recent federal elections when they've never voted Republican before. Some of them voted for Mitch McConnell, and they've never voted for Mitch McConnell. So Republicans see a real chance there. But with all of that said, I would not underestimate Democrats. You know, the most recent elections we had were these series of four special House elections. And I think most people thought that the best the Democrats could hope for was a 2-2 split, and they won 3 out of 4. So you can't count them out. They're very strong. These races, it really comes down to personality, the force of personality. And so it's just going to be fascinating to watch this fall as these campaigns develop. How do they run? Do they have a coordinated message? Do the Democrats run against Matt Bevin and his budget cuts? All be really fascinating things to watch.
Will the Trump candidacy and the Trump versus Clinton presidential race have coattails in these races?
Historically, those kinds of top of the ballot candidates don't, but in this case, I think they will. In fact, I think Trump will easily win Kentucky. I think there was a gentleman earlier, I guess from Pike County, who talked about the dissatisfaction of voters and that the media and the party establishment hadn't picked up on. Trump brings those voters out. They're more likely to vote Republican. The other big difference is between this and previous cycles for Democrats is there is a Republican, not a Democratic governor. And people say, well, what difference does that make? It's called fundraising. The governors can raise significant amounts of money from people who do or wish to do business with the state. And minority parties cannot do that kind of fundraising. So I think that will make a big difference. Mitch McConnell has made this a priority. There are going to be super PAC who lend money for the state races. I'm not predicting that the Republicans win. I'm just saying that it's different in the past. And the irony to me of the Trump factor is, if you believe conventional wisdom, although recent polls are already indicating better be careful of conventional wisdom, but, you know, Republicans are worried nationally that Trump could cost them the Senate majority. And Trump might simultaneously cost Mitch McConnell and Greg Stumbo their majorities in Kentucky.
Well, when you talk about the fact that the fact that a lot of the supporters of Trump are folks who have traditionally voted Democrat in the past, will they not possibly split their votes, vote for the Republican top of the ticket, and continue to vote in a more traditional Democratic manner the rest of the ticket?
Well, you know, what I said earlier may have been a little bit misunderstood, given that the caller picked up on it as well. What I'm talking about are those Democrats that in the past several election cycles, let's just pick a place, about 1992 or 4 forward, have remained what we call legacy Democrats. Their families have always been Democrats. They live in counties where the local officials are all Democrats, and therefore they want to vote in the primary. And they have remained on the rolls as Democrats. But they've essentially been Republicans for a decade or more, and they have voted that way in federal races. Trump's going to bring out the additional frustrated, we want to blow the system up and start again voters. And those are the ones that I think are more likely to benefit the Republicans.
But Trump is not a traditional Republican.
No, he's not a traditional anything, apparently.
But the other way these federal elections are going to spill on down is that the specter of Barack Obama, President Obama, will still be on the ballot in some ways. Hillary Clinton represents some semblance of continuity with the Obama administration, and, you know, especially pro-coal people in Kentucky, you know, have, I think we have seen, they've run against Obama forever, and will, this is, you know, might be the last, maybe, election that we'll see him, you know, in these campaign ads, you know, that Democrats...
Last battle in the war on coal.
That Democrats have, you know, that these state Democrats are somehow aligned with President Obama's platform.
And I wanted to pick up on something you said, too, John, about making a distinction. I think a lot of these voters do make a distinction because, you know, they look nationally and they say, oh, the Democratic Party, they're liberals, I don't agree with them. But then they look at their state representative, oh, not my guy, you know, or my woman. I know him or her. You know, I see them at church. I see them at the grocery store. That's what makes these state house races so fascinating is they're so small, they're so intimate, that people do make distinctions, I believe, at those levels.
And what should we be looking for as we move toward November for the house races? Will there be some indications with some that we'll get a sense of where it's going to go?
Well, I think someplace, something that may have a disproportionate impact may be in the courtrooms, because depending on how these suits on, you know, Bevin won the first round in the higher education suit. If that were to be overturned, you can be sure the Democrats are going to run against it. There are some
and
other.
And there's a possibility that could get overturned yet.
Sure,
that's why that's why he's asked Bevin not to take any action and not to do anything with the funds.
And there are going to be other debates like that. And I think that Democrats will run against Bevin and will run against those kinds of cuts.
They can still run against him. I mean, you have all these colleges announcing all these layoffs yesterday. KCTCS is eliminating 500 jobs. Not all of them are employees losing jobs, but some of them are vacant positions, but it's still jobs going away. I think Democrats can still, you know, jump on that.
Any other comments as we wrap up our conversation on this primary election and looking forward into a very interesting presidential election, the role of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, or anything else we need to be keeping our eye on? Any projections? Does the Jim Gray candidacy have any chance versus Rand Paul?
I think Jim Gray is going to have a tough time. I think he's probably the best candidate that the Democrats could have hoped for because he has the ability to self-finance. He can spend enough money on his campaign to make it viable. But it's just going to be difficult. It's always difficult to go after an incumbent. And I think he's going to find this really difficult.
And in this section of Central Kentucky, a Nancy Joe Kemper versus an Andy Barr.
Same sort of scenario. It's just you've got a well-funded incumbent in a conservative state, and she'll have a hard time doing it.
Thank you, Ronnie Ellis. Thank you, Adam Beam. Thank you, Ryland Barton, for being with us for a Reporters Roundtable talking about this week's primary election. You all are going to be invited back. You can I can guarantee that to you during the course of the next number of months as we continue to focus on politics as we look toward the presidential election. So thanks again for being here with us. Eastern Standard is a production of WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. We've had assistance at putting together this program from Brian Burkhart. Brian Bartlett, our operations manager at WEKU, has been at the controls. We remind you the show repeats on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock and will be available as a podcast at some point on Thursday afternoon. Write to us at any time, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. I'm John Hingsbergen for WEKU.